All week, we have been talking about factors related to diagnosing mental health conditions, but also, and maybe more specifically, challenges with making diagnoses and what happens when we, or factors contributing to misdiagnoses.
This has been an interesting week because it is a good reminder. Mm-hmm. It was for me. Yeah. It's kind of a refresher course on making mistakes, mm-hmm. medical mm-hmm. errors. And it's been a good reminder. I think if we had interns or we were still teaching, I think I would advise them that at least once a year, go into this literature right. and remind yourself. Now, our licensing boards do require that we take a course right. every 2 years
yeah.
in medical errors.
Right.
So that's a bit of a reminder, but yeah. This has been a good refresher course for me to be careful because right. we're talking about missing diagnoses that are there mm-hmm. and misdiagnosing what we see.
Diagnosing okay. something that's not there.
That's right. That's right. Either missing one, diagnosing something that isn't there, or making the wrong diagnosis.
Well, as you've referred to it before, errors of omission and errors of commission.
Right. That's right.
So we've talked about that all week. We've talked about issues and challenges associated mm-hmm. with diagnosing children.
Right.
We've talked about issues and challenges associated with diagnosing adults.
Right.
Factors that the clinician brings to the table.
That's right.
Brings to the table as it relates to making diagnoses mm-hmm. and missing things. And today we're going to talk about some of the consequences. What happens when we make some of these errors?
Right. What can happen to an individual? We have to remember that. Let's give her story. It's
right.
a her. It's a 23-year-old, now 23-year-old college yeah. student. It started when she was in her first year, and she self-identifies
yeah.
As a student at American University in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's public. This is a case study from a website called Alternet.com,
right.
and it's one that we haven't heard of before. We pull articles and things from all right. kinds of sources, and so we don't know too much about this. This site, but this is a great story that we thought we would share.
Right, that's right. It's not the site. It happens to appear in this because one of the things we want to be very careful about is there is a considerable amount of literature out there
mm-hmm.
that psychiatry is somehow conspiratorial,
right.
and there's some link with drug companies, and they talk about big pharma, and
right.
and it's a conspiratorial kind of approach,
mm-hmm.
and we want to avoid that. I mean,
right.
that's not what we're doing here.
Okay, right.
we're just saying that sometimes we include ourselves.
Yeah.
Sometimes we make a mistake,
right?
And it's important for us to be more careful, and for everybody to be aware of that and
right.
what to do if it happens to you,
right? And we are part of the mental health field,
right.
part of the field of psychology and psychiatry. And there is no annual meeting where we get together and say, you know, this is what diagnosis we're going to really focus on this year,
right.
to, you
That's
know,
right.
because the pharmaceutical companies are coming out with these new medications, and we need to make sure there's lots of these diagnoses.
Right.
That doesn't happen. That doesn't exist. And so there is no conspiracy as it relates to any of that.
Right. And as psychologists, we don't have prescription privileges, so what
right.
we do has nothing to do with medication.
Right.
Okay. It doesn't matter. I mean, financially, we have no benefit
right.
About medication. So,
right.
But this is an interesting case study about a single person. At the end of the same article that's posted, she talks about another person she knew who had
right.
a similar experience, but we'd like to focus on her experience
right.
because I think it is an example of all the things that can go wrong. This is a single person who experienced all of the worst pitfalls
mm-hmm.
that can occur if you're given a diagnosis that you shouldn't have
mm-hmm.
or you're given the wrong diagnosis.
Right. And I'll let you kind of go through the story, but at the time of the writing, she was a 23-year-old college student.
Right.
She talks about having, as is often the case, that initial diagnosis of ADHD or sort of ADHD as a rule out
right.
When she was a child.
Right.
But things changed over time.
Right. And what The story picks up with her as a freshman mm-hmm. in college.
Right.
And as a freshman, she was probably having the typical adjustments right. that kid freshmen everywhere have. And so she went to the counseling center at American University. Mm-hmm. And they were so full, which is another whole topic about increasing rates of mental illness among college students or mental health issues. She went to the counseling center and they didn't have any space. They didn't have any room. They couldn't see her. So they referred her to a psychiatrist in the Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist did a brief assessment,
right.
a very brief assessment, and rendered a diagnosis of generalized anxiety disorder.
Right.
Not surprising. She probably did have some anxiety.
Sure.
And depression.
Right.
Not surprising because she probably had some depressive symptoms. She was right. leaving home for the first time and in college and at a Absolutely. Major university and a lot of pressure. So it's not surprising that she would have those symptoms. But in making the diagnosis, he then added two medications,
right.
Neurontin
right.
and Lexapro
right.
to treat those two mm-hmm. disorders. That began a downward spiral because now she was taking medications that she probably didn't need.
Right.
And she was getting into the side effects of the medication.
Right.
It's a complicated issue, but basically the medication wasn't binding to things in her brain, and so it was creating significant adverse side effects.
Right.
Right? Which were coming out looking like mental health symptoms.
Right. And that's one of the big issues is that when the incorrect treatment is provided, especially when that incorrect treatment involves medication,
right.
Obviously, we're changing brain chemistry.
Right.
And when we change brain chemistry, we're going to change behaviors.
You change behaviors.
Yeah. And when we change behaviors, things are going to start looking different.
And when people like us look at behaviors, we call them symptoms.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that's where the trouble begins, isn't mm-hmm. it? They're not just simple behaviors. They begin to look like symptoms. And we make our diagnoses based on symptoms, right. symptom presentation.
Right.
So that's where we get into a little bit of trouble. Now, what happens to this girl is she finishes the year mm-hmm. at her freshman year, mm-hmm. Struggling with the side effects of medication. She goes home for the summer.
Right.
And she goes to another doctor to try to get things worked out a little bit. And this doctor decides that based on her symptoms, mm-hmm. that she has bipolar disorder.
Right.
Okay. Again, on, I think, Tuesday of this week, we talked about bipolar disorder being one of the most frequently misdiagnosed right. Disorders. It was right. one of five that are mm-hmm. frequently misdiagnosed. And so, and indeed, that was the case with this girl, is that she goes home for the summer. Now she has a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. To treat bipolar disorder, you use a mood stabilizer.
Right.
Now she has Neurontin, Lexapro, an unnamed mood stabilizer,
right.
and he changes her antidepressant.
From Lexapro to something else.
To something else, okay. Right. So now she's on three medications, as far as we know, and now she has these mood stabilizers on board, and she began to complain about lethargy and memory, and she was tired, and it was probably a side effect of the medication.
Right.
So what's the treatment for that? Let's give her a stimulant.
Right.
Make her more active.
So we add Ritalin.
I didn't mean to laugh. But we add Ritalin because mm-hmm. Ritalin will take care of those symptoms.
Right.
So the problem so far is that whoever's treating her is treating her symptoms. Nobody right. has yet gotten to the underlying cause.
To the right diagnosis.
Right. They're all treating her symptoms, okay? Mm-hmm. So now she's on summer vacation and she's taking Ritalin. Mm-hmm. By the time she begins her second year at the university, she is so, she has become so active, mm-hmm. not manic, but she's on Ritalin. She mm-hmm. can't sleep. She's not eating. She can't concentrate. She can't focus. And she has to drop out of school.
Right.
So now her second year, she has to take a medical leave of absence. So she misses her second year of school altogether. In the course of the year, the side effects become worse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and she finally ends up in an inpatient psychiatric facility.
Mm-hmm.
to me, that's the saddest part of this whole thing.
Absolutely.
Is that for this young woman who begins with some mild symptoms of probably an adjustment issue, not an adjustment disorder, but she was adjusting to school.
Yeah.
And now, in about 12 or 14 months later, ends up in a psychiatric facility. Well, because she didn't have a lot of money, she ended up in a, probably a state-sponsored psychiatric facility, right, where with inadequate care.
Right.
Right.
Well, they're overwhelmed, and they have underfunded, and you know, and it's,
you don't want to castigate, you don't want to criticize, but that's just the way mental health care is dealt with in our culture today, in our country today, is that if you end up in one of these facilities, they can be pretty draconian circumstances. And she talks about every 15 minutes they were checked, no matter what they were doing, whether they were taking a shower or changing or whatever they were doing, there was no privacy. And there was, so that made things worse again. But she was finally able to leave there at some time during the year. She said that people got discharged. People were not discharged if they were violent. They would keep them if they were violent because they were considered a threat to others. Or if they were discharged if your insurance ran out. And we ran, we have that all the time.
Yes.
Typically, insurance will pay for 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s and 90s, you could be in a treatment center for 6 or 9 or 12 months, and insurance companies would pay for it. They're no longer doing that. They kept reducing it until now it's 30 days.
Right.
So what most mental health facilities are today are they're crisis stabilization units.
Mm-hmm.
You're put in, you're given medication, the insurance runs out in 30 days, and you're discharged, regardless of your status.
Right.
Unless you're a danger, you get discharged at the end of 30 days. Okay. So she leaves there. And she leaves this mental health facility and finally connects with a psychiatrist. She doesn't explain how, but a psychiatrist who listens to her story and starts to take her off these, at this point, 7 medications.
Right.
She's now taking 7 medications, and another psychiatrist takes over her care, and they begin to reduce the medications. And now she's on, until we get to no medications, okay? And then she talks about rebuilding her life. The problem is that she now is in debt because she has unpaid medical bills, tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Her credit score, her credit has been ruined because she's not able to pay the bills back. She's at least 3 years behind in school. Her classmates are graduating, have graduated. In the 5 years that she was being treated, her age, her peers, her classmates have graduated or they're in graduate school. So now this has delayed her career entry by 4 or 5 years, okay, before she can even begin to pay these debts off.
Right.
And so for her, it was a catastrophic experience, okay, that began with a misdiagnosis and a series of misdiagnoses over a 5-year period.
Okay? Right.
Now, that's one case.
Right.
The other thing that's happening in our country is that, and what I think we need to be especially cautious of, and I have not seen this discussed or talked about as a public health issue, is that the number of individuals who now qualify for government assistance because they have a mental illness has risen 2.5 times between 1987 and 2007. And the reason that's happening is because as we make more diagnoses, if you're poor, you will get Social Security income, SSI benefits. There are children with ADHD whose families get hundreds of dollars a month because the kids have ADHD. And we know that those numbers are increasing. All of the mental, especially among the poor, because it's easy to make that happen with the poor.
Right, and because they often have they often don't have access to treatment, you know, adequate treatment. And you know, this woman is a good case in point that, you know, when you don't have access to adequate treatment, and when I mean adequate treatment, That's not to suggest necessarily malpractice by the professionals.
Right. Right.
It just means inadequate from the perspective of, you know, frequency of visits, you know, and duration of visits, and those kinds of things, you know,
right.
and, you know, or even being able to access someone to have a visit.
Mm-hmm.
And we know there's some areas in the country, for example, that, you know, there's not a psychiatrist for hundreds of miles.
Right, exactly.
And mm-hmm. so it's, you know, your ability to get treatment in those areas is almost zero.
That's right. The National Alliance of Mental Illness produced a statistic several years ago, and it's held steady. It's been stable since then, that 80% of individuals, 80% of children who have a documented mental illness never receive treatment.
Right.
So and these kids are in school, and mm-hmm. they're struggling, and their teachers are struggling, and schools
right.
are struggling, but 80% never get treatment,
right.
Which is astonishing, but that's the state of mental health care. It's easy to blame this first psychiatrist, that mm-hmm. she went in there, and we don't know anything about the psychiatrist or the
right.
psychiatrist's training or background or what was going on.
Yeah.
It's troublesome that the writer said that it was a 10-minute visit
right.
with some standard questions,
mm-hmm.
and the diagnoses were made based on a 10-minute assessment. None of us were there. We don't know. You and I have talked about this. I have learned over the years that I'm careful not to make any definite impressions, diagnostic impressions, after just a couple of visits.
Right.
Because so many times I don't get the full story until the third mm-hmm. or fourth or fifth visit. We last week, earlier in the week, we talked about people with PTSD,
right.
you know, who may not mention,
mm-hmm.
and it's such a significant event in their life,
right?
Right? And they may not mention it
mm-hmm.
until they develop yeah. trust in you as a therapist.
Right.
I mean, very few people come in and tell their entire life story in the first hour.
Right.
Okay. So you're not getting the whole story. So mm-hmm. we need to be very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
Had this girl,
woman.
This young woman.
Yeah. She's an adult.
She was 18
yeah.
the first time. Had this young woman gone to the counseling center, they probably would have said, this is fairly typical community psychiatrist
mm-hmm.
who maybe doesn't know about, I mean, I don't know what the psychiatrist training and background is, but they may not have any knowledge of what it's like. What if they lived at home during their college years?
Right.
Right. And never experienced
yeah.
the adjustment that it takes. I'm not saying that the person's incompetent. They just may not know. And we talked about that earlier in the week about mm-hmm. What is it about the therapist, the psychiatrist,
right.
their background and training
right.
and theoretical orientation? Maybe it had nothing to do with competence. It's just
mm-hmm.
this was how they're trained, and this is the experience that the psychiatrist had.
Right.
Okay. So we don't mean to be critical, but a 10-minute, except for the 10-minute, you know, you get a diagnosis in a 10-minute interview, that's not sufficient.
Right.
For anything. Doesn't
Absolutely.
Matter what it is.
Yeah, so we were talking earlier this week when we kind of mentioned clinician-based
mm-hmm.
Issues. You know, we talked about, you know, training and those kinds of things, but certainly one of the things that we mentioned was what was that very fact, the timing issue, the amount of time that a physician or provider right. has to spend with their clients. I mean, we know
mm-hmm.
Medical professionals who have been, have had issues with their employer because they resist seeing a certain number of patients,
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
per week or per day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when you're talking about general practitioners,
right.
you know, the push is to see, you know, at least 4, if not 5 patients an hour. And when you fail to do that, you know, your employer kind of may get at you about that.
In where it hurts the most?
Financially.
Right.
They
hit your pocketbook.
Right. And so, you know, there are lots of those kinds of issues that contribute to this. But what I think is a great example or great reason to read this article is because what it points out is you can see the cascade of events that happen
right.
following the first time we have a misdiagnosis. As soon as that initial misdiagnosis is made, it's just, you know, domino after domino after domino after domino just keeps falling, and she continues to struggle, and things just get worse. And that's the biggest issue with the misdiagnosis.
Right. And on Wednesday, we talked about misdiagnoses in children, you know, and there's a wonderful article. I don't know whether, I don't remember whether we put it in the show notes or not, but it's, the title of the article is mental illness diagnoses in children should always be in pencil.
Right.
You know, which is a wonderful, so that you can change, because it might change, especially in children, because they're developing and changing over time.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens, is they're given this diagnosis at age 10, and it just stays with them.
Right.
Okay. There are two political, business. Here's what really bothers me. When medicine, like education, medicine is not a business.
Shouldn't be.
Shouldn't be a business. It's it's been turned into a business.
Right.
Like education is turned into a business. We talk about vouchers and, you know, these schools that private companies can do it better. Private companies can't do it any better than public education. We're going to, you will learn, I promise you, we are going to learn that. Nobody can do it better than public schools are doing it, because unless you get to select your students.
Right.
Okay, if you can cherry pick the students, you can do a better job. But if you're educating everybody, you're not going to, the private companies aren't going to do it any better.
Okay. Right.
Because education's not a business.
Right.
We're not building cars or furniture.
Right.
And medicine is not a business. Okay. And so to tell a physician, a competent, experienced, effective physician, that he or she has to see a certain number of patients every day is not a clinical decision. That's a business decision.
Right.
For a psychiatrist to be told, you have to see four patients an hour in order for us to keep the lights on, is not medicine. That's business, okay?
Right.
So we criticize the psychiatrist because all they're doing is, we say, all they're doing is a med check, and they just do medic. But that's all you can do in 15 minutes.
Right.
If your business is saying you have to see four an hour, then you're limited. Then you can't do a thorough evaluation and treatment.
Right. Yeah, I've heard arguments from people who say that, you know, one of the reasons we shouldn't go to universal healthcare here in the United States is because, this was an argument that I heard someone make just recently, is that fewer people will go into medicine if we do that, because physicians will make less money because they will, you know, they will only be able to accept certain patients, or they will only be able to be paid certain amounts for their for their services. And you know, there's so many issues with that. It's breathtaking. But the truth is, nobody goes into pediatrics to become rich.
No.
Nobody goes into psychiatry to be rich.
No.
I don't mean to burst anybody's bubble, but you know, if you're going into medicine to become really wealthy, you know, plastic surgery, you know, some areas of surgery in general, but you don't go into, into pediatrics.
Go into surgery, orthopedic surgery, cardiovascular surgery, neurosurgery.
Yeah.
If you want to make hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, there are places you can do that in medicine.
Right.
Nobody has ever gone into pediatrics to become wealthy.
Or psychiatry.
Or psychiatry, right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so it that argument, And again, to the point, if you're trying to practice psychiatry or pediatrics or general medicine through a business model to become very wealthy, it's just not going to pan out.
You know, one of the things we complain about, not we, but people complain about, is there are many psychiatrists who don't accept insurance.
Right.
Well, this is why they don't accept insurance, because they don't want to be limited by a business model. They want to be able to practice medicine the way they were taught and the way they know it should be practiced.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Because the point to that is that when you take insurance, the insurance dictates how much you make for whatever you are, whatever service you're providing.
Right.
So if it says you build this code, and you get paid this amount for that code. And that code is $30. You know, you're going to have to split up your hour to see multiple of those codes, to perform multiple of those codes in an hour, if you're going to be able to keep the lights on, even at a minimal.
How many codes are there?
Oh, there's a book that's, when we're talking about all the medical codes, we're talking about a book that's...
But even in psychiatry?
It's a
hundreds?
Probably.
Right. So you very casually, you did this earlier in the week, you said, what, these codes. You need to understand there are hundreds of codes that we have to choose from, okay? And each one has a different dollar amount attached to it.
And some of which aren't covered by the insurance.
Right.
The insurance company will say, nope, we don't do that one.
And if you happen to bill what you're doing, the insurance company can come back. You've done your work, you've done your time, you've done your best practice, and the insurance company will say, well, we don't reimburse for that. You've then just contributed your time and you're not getting reimbursed.
We had a new one this week, last week. It'd be great. The insurance company says, yes, we do cover that code.
Right.
We performed
it. It was an intervention or an assessment.
An assessment.
Okay, so you did the assessment that needed to be done.
The insurance company says, we do cover that assessment. I performed the assessment and get it all done so I can talk to the patient about what's going on. And then the insurance company says, oh, we covered that assessment, but not for that diagnosis. So now the patient is responsible for that. And we're talking about, this was a 4 or 5 hour evaluation.
And at this point, I would like to slam my fist on the table and throw a temper tantrum when I hear people say, we don't need healthcare reform in this country.
Right.
You know, no, we do. We really do, because everybody is suffering. Right. Everybody's paying a price. Unless you're a member of the United States Congress, then you're not paying a price because you have...
You said political earlier. So you're...
I know, but... I think that everybody in the country should have exactly the same insurance that all of our representatives have, because they have a Cadillac policy for life that covers everything for everybody for the rest of their lives, even if they serve one term in Congress. That's why they're not interested in health care, because it doesn't affect them. Mm-hmm. Okay, it affects all of us, doesn't affect them. Speaking of insurance companies, I discovered this when we first worked in psychiatry at USF. This was the first time I ever experienced it. Saw a patient, and I said, I'm not ready to make a diagnosis yet. Uh-huh. Oh, no.
You have to.
I said, but I'm not ready. I don't know enough about this boy to make a diagnosis.
I've only spent an hour with him. I don't know enough.
Right.
Yeah, right.
No. You have to. And what do you mean I have to make a diagnosis? He said, if you don't make a diagnosis, we cannot bill the insurance company.
Right.
We will not get reimbursed. So either we won't get reimbursed, or the family has to pay for the visit.
Right. Yeah.
Medicine is not a business and should not be run like a business.
Right.
And as long as we have the insurance companies dictating what we can and cannot do, it's a business model, not a medicine. So it's not care. It's business.
Right.
Okay.
And I know we are sort of reviewing things, kind of reiterating things that we've already talked about this week, but it's all of these things contribute to making misdiagnoses or identifying the wrong condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to, as we're thinking about what's happening with, or what the consequences are of making the wrong diagnosis, we need to... It's hard not to reiterate that stuff. But what this case study, this woman who presented her case, her life experience, demonstrates is that when we're looking at the consequences of making an inappropriate diagnosis or misidentifying something, we begin down a path that until someone steps back and says, hold on a minute, let's get back to the base, baseline, and let's see what's really happening. Until you see somebody who's willing to do that, and the patient is in a position where he or she is willing to do that, we're going to continue down this alternate life path. It always makes me think of, and I know that you'll roll your eyes. It always makes me think of Back to the Future. In Back to the Future, for the spoiler alert, though it's been out since the 80s, so you should have seen it already.
Wait a minute. Stop. Should have seen it?
Should have. Everybody should have seen Back to the
Sounds
Future.
Sounds like a moral imperative. Like, if you didn't, there's something wrong.
Is it not?
What?
Is it not a moral imperative?
Should have seen it.
So
you could say, in case you haven't seen it,
I mean, you should have seen it by now.
You should have seen it makes me feel like, wow.
Have you seen it?
Sort of.
Here we go.
I've seen parts of it. I've never watched the whole thing from beginning to end. How many were there? Two or three?
He hurts my feelings.
No. How many were there? Three. No, I haven't watched them. I've seen bits and pieces of one of them.
You should have seen it. Regardless of whether he's seen it or not, you should have seen it. All right. So, but you should have seen it by now. There's a part where he goes back in time and something changes back in the past. And what happens is it takes the world in this other trajectory. And so the future becomes very different for them based upon that one simple change. And it makes me always think about that when I hear cases like this woman where, mm-hmm. you know, as soon as she started taking those medications, she started following a different life path.
That's right.
The one that she was on before may have been mm-hmm. just fine. As you said, you know, it may have just been an adjustment to college and that life. But because she started taking medication, she started going on this different trajectory.
Right.
And we don't know what would have happened otherwise. We don't know what would have happened had that change not
right.
occurred, had she not mm-hmm. been given that medication. And it's really... It's troubling to me because, you know, we work with people to try to help them have a better life.
Right.
But there are those practitioners, those patients, who don't think about, don't necessarily think about, you know, okay, what consequences right. is going to happen here if we get this wrong? Much to your point of, you have to make a diagnosis at the first appointment. Okay. As though making a diagnosis is insignificant.
Right, and then if you do make that diagnosis at the first visit, if you remember to change the diagnosis as you get, what if you never see that person again?
Right.
What if that person, for some reason, moves or doesn't come back or says, okay, now I know it's bipolar disorder, okay? Right.
They don't come back, and in your mind, you're thinking, well, this is a tentative diagnosis. You know, as I see them, I'm going to refine
That's right.
it,
mm-hmm.
but they don't come back. And then, you know, a year later, they request a copy of your record so they can go to a different mm-hmm. psychiatrist. And now that psychiatrist says, oh, she was diagnosed with bipolar before.
Right.
So.
That must be what she had. Yeah. I mean, you know, if they don't question it, mm-hmm. and frequently they don't.
Right.
Okay. And we mentioned the residential treatment centers where they have these, they bring in these diagnoses,
right.
which may or may not be accurate.
Right.
Okay. But unless you question them, mm-hmm. You and I question them, but not everybody does.
Right.
Okay. Unless you question them, that diagnosis, it's going to become part of your permanent medical record.
Right.
It's with today's world, these mm-hmm. are electronic records, and right. they stay with you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, and how about this? You apply for a job and say, have you ever been diagnosed with a mental illness?
Right. Yeah.
What do you put down?
Right.
You know,
exactly.
you don't have a mental illness because it was a misdiagnosis, but you're lying if you say no.
Right.
Or what if you don't even know you had one? And then they go back and check your records.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, we looked at your medical records
right.
and
right.
you lied.
Yeah.
You know, you were and so, you know, there are all kinds of implications.
Right.
Personal, financial. It's tragic what happened to this young woman.
Yeah.
That at 23 years of age, she has no credit. She's in debt for services that she didn't need.
Right.
Fortunately, when you read the end of the story, she reconnected with a boyfriend and was back in school and seems to be doing well. Fortunately, she was resilient enough
mm-hmm.
to survive
right.
the tragedy. A lot of people
aren't.
Wouldn't have been able right. to survive this. I mean,
right.
to me, it attests to her basic mental health to begin with,
right.
is that she was able to tolerate the trauma, and I mean trauma,
right.
that she went through and the medication side effects, and was able to come through it and is functioning
right.
functioning well.
Right.
So it speaks to her resilience.
Right.
Not everybody has that.
Right. And I think it's important to reiterate the significance of a misdiagnosis leads to inappropriate treatment, and in many cases it leads to the use of medications that aren't right. necessary, aren't correct, and the consequences of that can be so mm. profound. Right. Because if you're giving somebody, as is, was the case with this woman, if you give someone the wrong medication, you're going to begin to elicit the wrong symptoms. Right. And when you're eliciting what will look like symptoms but are really side effects of, right. of medication, mm-hmm. again, you're going to start going down this path of, well, we're going to diagnose this. And then we get into polypharmacy, where you're on multiple right. medications. She was on seven medications mm-hmm. at one point.
Right.
And she was taking seven. Who knows if she needed any of them?
She was taking seven pills a day yeah. at the end. Yeah.
So the diagnosis is so important right. because that, we've said it dozens of times this week, the diagnosis informs treatment. And when you have the wrong diagnosis, you're going to have the wrong treatment. I think that the psychiatrist that I initially trained with, Dr. Silver, yeah. he always said that when you get the right diagnosis, you're going to provide the right treatment.
Right.
If anytime you have a patient or mm-hmm. anytime you experience a situation where the medication works for a little while, but then it stops working.
Right.
That's a pretty good indication that it's the wrong diagnosis.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. medication is going to change you. So you mm-hmm. may see some change initially when you first start taking it. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting better realistically. I mean, you're going to have that change and so, oh, well, mm-hmm. look, some of those symptoms are changing and so maybe right. we're getting better. We're going to interpret it that way. But just because you see a change in behavior with the medication doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct.
Right.
After you give it some time, and then all of a sudden, as people often say, well, then the medication just stops working and I have to go try something else.
Right.
The first time the medication stops working, that should be a cue that I really need to look at my diagnosis again. I need to mm-hmm. look at what I'm thinking is actually going on here mm-hmm. because that medication should work.
If it's that diagnosis.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But
yeah, we've seen children with ADHD who come in here and they go on medication and it's a miraculous change.
Right.
Because they really do have ADHD.
Right.
Okay. And we've seen other cases where it's been catastrophic because right. it sends them in a different direction or Absolutely. It's not effective at all. Mm-hmm. Well, that means you don't have the right diagnosis.
Yeah.
These things take time. They take time and care to work out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Insurance companies should not be in charge of healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
And right now they are.
Yeah.
Physicians and practitioners, therapists, clinicians mm-hmm. should be in charge of healthcare, not companies.
Right. Okay.
So if you want to change something, take all that passion for big pharma and start talking about insurance companies
yeah.
and some kind of managed care, some kind of universal care that everybody gets. Everybody in this country should receive the treatment that he or she deserves.
Right.
Okay. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think you guys, men and women in Washington, you have your insurance. How about doing something to provide the rest of the country with what they need?
Yeah. Now, the last point, I think, that we need to make here mm-hmm. is we've beat up medication well enough, when we're getting the diagnosis wrong, that, mm-hmm. and deservedly so. Mm-hmm. But we do have to look at the other side for a moment and talk about briefly what happens when we have the wrong diagnosis and we provide even the wrong psychotherapy.
Right.
There are times when we employ psychotherapeutic approaches for a diagnosis when it's the wrong diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And certainly the consequences are very different than if it was a medication.
Right.
You know, you're changing chemistry very directly mm-hmm. and much more quickly with one over the other. But there yeah. are times when practitioners, and you know, there are certainly times when I will admit that I have gotten it wrong for one reason
yeah,
or another.
We all
have.
Absolutely.
But there are times when people make recommendations, professionals make recommendations, that are the wrong recommendation.
Non-drug.
Non-medication-based right. recommendations right. that are wrong.
Right.
You know, there are times, for example, and not necessarily picking on anyone in particular or any particular group of individuals in particular, but, you know, if a person is in a troubled, abusive, damaging marriage,
right.
and you're approaching that from the perspective that, well, divorce is wrong, right. and you should stay in the stay in a marriage regardless of what's happening,
mm-hmm.
That is likely the wrong intervention.
I have no problem with agreeing with that.
Right.
Because like insurance companies shouldn't drive it, religion shouldn't drive it.
Well, and I'm not even necessarily just talking about religion. I'm just talking about personal perspectives. You
right.
know, you may have lived through a relationship that was abusive and you were able to get through it and your partner changed and you guys worked through those things and it got better. It doesn't mean that everyone will. And if a person is being abused or injured and it's a religious perspective or it's a personal perspective that says, no, you know, our perspective, our view here, our approach here is that we completely disregard divorce as an option
right.
or ending those relationships as an option, you're doing a disservice to your patients and you're doing, you're potentially causing harm by allowing that person to remain in a relationship or encouraging that person to remain in a relationship where they're getting injured.
I was just gonna say, first, do no harm.
Right.
Okay, and
absolutely.
I think we should live by the same code.
Right.
First, do no harm. If I know that my patient is being harmed physically mm-hmm. or emotionally or sexually, I have an obligation.
Right.
Okay, and so my personal beliefs
right.
can't cloud that decision.
Right.
I have an obligation to protect mm-hmm. protect my patient.
Right.
And
yeah.
so, no, that I absolutely agree with you.
Right. And we talked already about some of the other limitations or aspects of diagnosing and treatment that the clinician brings to the table that causes problems. We've already talked about that, but on yesterday's podcast. But again, the issue is that when we're applying a treatment based upon an inappropriate diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
it's going to, again, cause that same change in trajectory for the patients we're working with. Another easy example is when you're working with kids.
Yeah.
You know that, and a lot of people don't know this, and I certainly didn't know it until I was working in the schools. When a student has an individual education plan, an IEP,
mm-hmm.
it is decided when they're 14 years old whether or not they're going to be on a track for a standard diploma
right.
or a special diploma or mm-hmm. a certificate of completion.
Right.
At the time that they enter high school, at the time mm-hmm. that they're in ninth grade, it's decided whether or not they're going to be on a path to graduate with a real diploma or not. If it's decided because of a misdiagnosis, because
right.
we're not paying attention to all the factors that are related, and that kid is put on a path for a certificate of completion, it will begin on day one of high school that they will not meet all the criteria necessary to graduate.
They're not expected to.
They're not expected to.
But they begin with the expectation that this student doesn't have to complete the 24 Carnegie units because he's not going to get a regular diploma
right.
anyway.
They don't have to complete the courses. They don't have to complete the testing necessary.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to complete...
That's right. They're exempt from all those state tests.
Right. They have to sit for them, but they don't have to pass them. So their scores aren't even
right.
really... So they don't receive additional services or the
mm-hmm.
you know any other interventions that they could benefit
from. You mentioned the IEP. Frequently, IEPs are followed fairly religiously in elementary school,
mm-hmm.
okay, because typically kids are in the same school and
right.
and it's passed from year to year. They get to middle school, and frequently they end up in a file cabinet somewhere,
right.
and the school doesn't even know they have an IEP.
Right.
And in high school, it's forgotten altogether,
right.
and you're right. By the time they get there, people may not even know that the child has one.
Right.
You know,
all that is already decided, and they just look for the checkbox that says
right.
standard diploma or certificate.
And if the parents aren't paying attention, and frequently they don't know because they don't know the intricacies
mm-hmm.
of the law, they wouldn't know to ask those questions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So whether we're talking about education, we're talking about family systems,
right.
or we're talking about individuals applying the wrong even psychological therapeutic intervention,
educational
has long-term consequences.
Exactly.
And so we have to make sure that our diagnoses are correct, and that our that the approach that we're bringing to the table is the right approach for that patient that you're seeing across across the room.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why we harp so much, both on the podcast and in our clinic here, that you have to get the right diagnosis.
Right.
And when we teach, you know, future clinicians, we emphasize you need to know what the diagnoses are.
Right. Right. Yeah. Don't do your work to satisfy the insurance company. Do your work to satisfy the needs of the people you're seeing.
Absolutely. You know,
let that dictate what you're doing.
That's it.
And you'll avoid some of these mistakes.
Right. So, all right. We got going with that one.
Yeah, well, it brings up that whole issue of, you know, we're in sort of a mess right now.
Right.
People don't realize, I don't think most people realize just how bad it is until they fall victim to the
right.
system.
Yeah.
When they come in, as you said, and they're told, oh no, we don't cover it for that diagnosis.
Right.
Who would have known that?
Right.
I mean,
well, the people that...
you learn after the fact.
Right.
And then there's no choice.
Right.
You know? And so... this whole insurance thing needs to be revisited.
Right.
I mean, whether you agree with the Affordable Care Act, at least it was a step and it solved some of the problems, and it could have been a good beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So if government wants to dismantle that one, okay, but what are you going to replace it with?
Right.
Because right now the system isn't working very well.
Right, absolutely.
And it's sad that people continue to get ensnared
right.
and have to suffer the consequences.
Absolutely. So. All right. Well,
we could keep talking.
Again, remember that this entire week that we've done here was came from a recommendation from a listener mm-hmm. who wrote into us on YouTube. Now I don't remember if it was YouTube or just email.
It was YouTube. Right.
But we really appreciate the question. And if you have any questions or topics that you would like for us to cover, you know, send them in. Either comments on one of our videos on YouTube, mm-hmm. Or you can write to us on the website. On any of the websites, the Mental
right.
Breakdown or PsychReg podcast, and let us know what topics you're interested in, and we will be sure to put together some thoughts, put together some information, and share it with you as best we can.
Right. And if we haven't answered your question, for those of you who requested that we discuss misdiagnosis, if this week didn't answer your questions, write back and let us know, and
absolutely.
We'll be happy to address those specific questions.
Definitely.
Okay.
So, all right, that is it for today and this week. Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.